Hi, this is Donna Shapley, and I thank you so much for joining me today as we take our final look at the October issue of Cincinnati Magazine. Today I would like to conclude an article I began reading last week, one of the feature stories coinciding with the cover story, Wine and Spirits, entitled Grape Expectations by Akshay Ahuja. The skeleton root revives a local winemaking tradition that once made Cincinnati the Rhineland of America. As MacDonald walks me through her Clarksville, Ohio vineyard in Clinton County, not far from Wilmington, she discusses Cincinnati's inconsistent weather. Spring and summer can bring endless weeks of rain, triggering massive spore releases of fungal diseases like black rot and powdery mildew. A damp grapevine that won't dry off is likely to become a sick one. After MacDonald moved back here, she remembers observing a local vineyard and finding only American grapes surviving. Suddenly, she had a similar realization to Longworth's back in the day. Why not grow what wants to be here? American grape varieties are unique in a number of ways. European grapes, perhaps from their longer relationship with humans, are somewhat better behaved, and, with proper training, bear their bunches neatly on the lower rungs of a trellis. American grapes have what MacDonald describes as an insane vigor, with a tendency to climb supports and then cascade down, hogging the sunlight with their much larger leaves. The berries of cultivated American grapes also tend to be much bigger than vinifera, leading to a higher ratio of juice to skin. This leads to lower tannin levels. Tannins are the astringent, mouth-puckering quality prominent in red wines, mainly found in the skins and pips. Also, grapes like Catawba require a long growing season to develop their sugars, and they generally never get as sweet as vinifera grapes growing in a Mediterranean or California climate. Wines made from these American grapes, then, tend to have a lower alcohol content. You need sugars to ferment into alcohol, and a more acidic flavor. These aren't flaws, in MacDonald's view. They're just part of the distinctive quality of our region's wines. Even in Longworth's day, though, this wine was a hard sell at home. Americans liked their wines sweet and boozy, sometimes, he said, up to 80 proof, and often adulterated with spirits. Longworth considered making a pure wine part of his contribution to temperance. Longworth soon managed to find a population that not only liked his wines, but would work his vineyards. Immigrants from the Rhineland region began flooding into Cincinnati in the 1840s, and many of them, as he said, had been bred from their infancy to the cultivation of the vine. Longworth would sometimes house these German workers and have them care for his vineyards. But generally, he'd give them a few acres to cultivate, press the grapes, and then split the profits with them. Longworth said his workers recognized in his wine a close likeness to the drinks of their native Rhine Valley, only much cheaper than the imports, and consumed it enthusiastically. homegrown Americans, unfortunately, had a different reaction. Our own people did not take to it very kindly, read one account from 1857. To their palates, it seemed a trifle too much like sour cider to realize their idea of pleasant drink. An accidental breakthrough began to change some of these perceptions. One time, a pressing of Catawba was bottled with enough sugar left to undergo a second fermentation in the bottle. The result? Bubbles. Sensing he was on to something, Longworth tried to duplicate the success and eventually, with the help of an experienced fabricante from the Champagne region of France, got his process down, albeit with some hiccups. Bottles couldn't always stand the pressure of the second fermentation and would burst in large numbers. In 1 year, 42,000 out of 50,000 bottles were lost, so many that Longworth installed grates in the cellar to collect the spilled juice and cook it down into something he called Catawba brandy. When the bottles didn't explode, though, they were a sensation. From the first, reads an article from The Time, demand has far outrun the possibility of supplying it. The sparkling Catawba is known all over the country and commands the same price as Moët and Heidsieck champagne. Longworth insisted on the name sparkling Catawba rather than champagne or any of the other terms from Europe. I shall not attempt to imitate any of the sparkling wines of Europe, he wrote in 1849. He wanted to produce a pure article having the peculiar flavor of our native grape. As Longworth's wines began to achieve a reputation, both in America and abroad, people paid him the ultimate compliment of creating cheap knockoffs. To respond to the flood of imitators, and as a way to share and improve their viticultural practices, Cincinnati winemakers founded the American Wine Growers Association in 1851. Inspired by Longworth's successes, several other growers had entered the wine market, including wealthy local merchants like Robert Buchanan and Thomas Carneal. The acreage devoted to grapes increased rapidly. As described in John F. Vondacki's bulletin, Grape Growing and Winemaking in Cincinnati, there were 114 acres under cultivation in 1845. Just 5 years later, there were an astonishing 300 vineyards within a 20-mile radius of the city, covering 900 acres, with half of those in active production. In 1853, the peak year for Cincinnati's wine industry, 320,000 gallons of wine were pressed from 800 acres of grapes and bottles with names like Longworth's Sparkling Catawba and Golden Eagle were known all over the world. As MacDonald worked on developing her wines, she spent hours in the Cincinnati Historical Society Library reading old articles from Harper's and Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper and reviewing Longworth's own notes. In books like The Culture of the Grape and Winemaking by Robert Buchanan, with an appendix by Longworth on strawberry cultivation, which had already gone through five editions by 1856, it's apparent that the men of the era were much more interested in disseminating knowledge than in guarding trade secrets. The amazing thing, MacDonald notes, is that except for a few of the large producers, the basic procedures, especially for making sparkling wine, hasn't changed since Longworth's time. Sure, there are now temperature-controlled stainless steel tanks and, thankfully, much sturdier bottles, but otherwise it's the same hydrometer to measure dissolved sugars in the liquid and the same painstaking process of twisting the bottles to gather the spent yeast sediment at the top, known as riddling, and disgorging it by freezing that chunk to pop it out. I ask David Schildknecht, a prominent critic specializing in wines of Germany and Austria, who happens to live in Cincinnati, to come taste the results of MacDonald's years of research and labor. One evening, out to the table comes an effervescent wine, delicately pink from a brief period of time, resting on its skins and eagerly waiting to emerge in a rush of bubbles. The closest thing to a Longworth sparkling Catawba in over a century. On the bottle is a phoenix paying homage to the rebirth of Nicholas Longworth's happy accident. It's rustic, simple, refreshing, and a perfect reflection of the fruit, our own local rosé, with its own unique character. MacDonald's proudest achievement with Catawba, though, is her still wine. Longworth knew then that any acidic wine needs aging, and he always let his Catawba sit for years in barrels. Long contact with oak allows a second fermentation, when harsher malic acid, the tart quality of green apples, mellows into lactic acid, the softer tartness of yogurt, while also creating new texture and flavor complexities. MacDonald uses old European oak barrels, which contribute less of the oak flavor while still allowing the wine to mellow. Like Longworth, she wants the distinctive flavor of the fruit, rather than the wood, to do most of the talking. Schildknecht is particularly impressed with the still Catawba, which MacDonald had barrel-aged for 4 years. He mentions the sharp qualities of rhubarb combined with cool, crunchy greenness of cucumber and fermentative twang, and senses what MacDonald describes as her style, as it was Longworth's, to intervene as little as possible in the wine's character. It doesn't hide its acidity and is a suitable accompaniment to food, especially creamy dishes or marbled meats that need something sharp to stand up to them. Schildknecht hesitates to characterize the particular pungency of the Catawba grape that might have put off other winemakers. The word used about American grapes since Longworth's time, and that MacDonald clearly finds a bit annoying, is foxy, which mainly serves to confuse, since most people can't immediately call up the musky smell of a fox or decide whether or not this aroma would be a good thing in a glass of wine. The best idea might just be to taste without prejudice or preconceptions. The skeleton root hand-makes all of its wine in an old manufacturing building on McMicken Avenue in Over the Rhine and sells 8 to 10 varieties at any one time in its tasting room. Wine can also be shipped to most states. The production of wine around Cincinnati began to decline after 1853, not for lack of demand, but from the increased prevalence of fungal diseases, for which there was no real treatment at the time. On his deathbed in 1863, Longworth was still talking about a vine that might resist powdery mildew and black rot, his two great nemesises. Soon the local acreage devoted to grapes shrank to almost nothing, until all that remained of the Rhineland of America was Longworth's estate, some wild vines reported to still haunt Columbia Tusculum and Eden Park, and a nickname, the Queen City, derived from Longfellow's famous poem about Catawba wine. A few local businesses, including Vincolette in Coleraine Township and Meyer in Silverton, have kept the winemaking tradition alive here, though Vincolette generally uses vinifera grapes and Meyer, which does use Catawba and other American varieties, produces much sweeter wines. In some ways, Longworth's viticultural legacy didn't really die. It simply migrated north to the Lake Erie region, where disease pressures were less intense. Grape growing continues there to this day, including many acres of American grape varieties like Catawba, Norton, and Isabella. When MacDonald began looking to make these historically inspired wines, in fact, she sourced her grapes from the Lake Erie area. She wondered whether our slightly longer growing season, with the grape concentrating a few more sugars in the fruit, would make a better wine. She's finally ready to test out this theory on the ground. In the culmination of a dream, MacDonald and Jackson have found nearby land on which to grow their own grapes. One site is the existing vineyard in Clarksville, where she plans to continue to grow the vinifera varieties that thrive in our climate. And she plans to use a new site in Indiana to grow Catawba and the American varieties. In 1850, Robert Buchanan wrote that we have much to learn yet in the art of making wines, and MacDonald agrees. Since Longworth's pioneering experiments were cut short, we just don't know very much about these grapes and the conversation they might have with our current soil and climate. We have powerful tools today that Longworth might have envied, like chemical fungicides and herbicides. MacDonald uses them when necessary, but is also wary of them. The more you spray, she says, the less you have an expression of the land in your glass. The soil becomes a sterile medium, and you lose the subtle concept the French call terroir, the unique expression of a particular area. Longworth spent a long time listening to the land around Cincinnati. After more than a century of silence, MacDonald is restarting the conversation and pressing the results into something delicious. Soon, maybe, Longfellow's words will be true again. Richest and best is the wine of the West that grows by the beautiful river. And that concludes Grape Expectations by Ashjay Ahuja. Next, we'll turn to Living in CIN by Jay Gilbert. The Fall of Uncle Al. Were you there that time the children's show Icon played at Masonette? I was. If you were born in Cincinnati between 1946 and 1981, put away your crummy little birth certificate. It means nothing. hardcore proof of your Queen City origin requires an infinitely more powerful document, the group photo from that time you were on the Uncle Al show. Just about every local baby boomer and Gen Xer recalls his or her Uncle Al experience. Not me. I arrived here in my mid-20s, my childhood bereft of even a single alakazam. That's fine, because I've got a glorious adult memory of something you don't. The evening I spent with Uncle Al at Cincinnati's legendary Masonette restaurant. I have a video showing this celebrated TV icon standing up among the invited guests, strapping on his accordion, and turning a 5-star restaurant into a kindergarten. Go ahead, show me your group photo of that. You might think that the formal surroundings would have inspired Al to perform something understated, like, "Thank you, God, for this, my day," the little prayer he used to sing at the end of each episode. Wrong. He belted out, "Zippity-doo-dah, do the hokey-pokey, and take me out to the ball game." Try to imagine this scene being witnessed 3 tables away by an elderly couple who'd come to Masonette from Lexington for their 50th wedding anniversary. The story of this special night has never been told, and since several of its attendees have passed away, I feel compelled to leave a record while there's still time. Yes, there's that video. But there's a problem. The night's most exciting moment, even more bizarre than a man in an oversized bow tie playing zippity-doo-dah at Masonette, has been edited out. I condemn such Stalin-like manipulation of history and will now reveal what really happened. By April 2002, Al Lewis had been long retired, but the public tributes for him continued, and on this night he was at the head table for the latest gathering of La Masonette 50. Never heard of this exclusive group? That's because you're a low-rent, flea-infested subhuman. Membership in La Masonette 50 was roughly the blue blood version of a Cincinnati Bengals seat license. Your hefty upfront payment purchased the esteemed privilege of being obligated to make further payments, which then allowed, i.e. required, you to attend a minimum number of home venue events. Direct comparison of membership in La Masonette 50 with a Bengals seat license is imprecise, with one major difference. There is unanimous agreement on this point, being the quality of the food. How did I wind up at such a swank occasion? I definitely wasn't a member of La Masonette 50, and it's a safe bet that they weren't trying to seduce me into joining. Like the protagonist in the movie Slumdog Millionaire, though, I found myself in such a surprisingly upscale situation thanks to an accumulation of small coincidences. My career in local media, being on the radio, writing for publications like this one, and prostituting myself for the advertising industry, brought me into contact with prominent Cincinnatians. Among them was Nat Commissar. He and his cousin Michael were proprietors of one of the most highly regarded restaurants on earth, Masonette. Their establishment was so special, it had no need for a name beginning with "the." As it turns out, this headed off litigation from Ohio State University. Ever since receiving its first mobile 5-star award in 1964, repeated for another 40 record-breaking years, a finer venue in Cincinnati was not to be found. Honey, I got the job. Let's call Masonette. Dad, this is your diploma as much as mine. I'm taking you and Mom to Masonette. David and Jennifer, Indian Hill, cordially invite you to the marriage of their daughter, Elizabeth, to Roger Up-and-comer of Hyde Park. Reception to be held in the Versailles Room at Masonette, 114 East 6th Street, Cincinnati, Ohio. Nat had long considered publishing a book about the history of his family's honored restaurant, and he invited me to participate after he'd seen some of my writing. We met with some publishers and I wrote sample chapters. Things might have progressed further had Cincinnati not suffered through riots, downtown's decline, and Masonette's eventual closing. But back when the book was still being planned, Nat invited me to a special dinner featuring Uncle Al and his wealthiest fans to provide me a feel, I suppose, for how the other half percent lives. Well, now, I was ready for the luxurious surroundings, the sumptuous wardrobes, the mostly undetectable hairpieces, and, of course, the magnificent food. What I wasn't ready for was the attack of the Henny Youngmans. When the meal ended, Nat didn't introduce Uncle Al. He brought up a pair of co-hosts, longtime members of La Masonette 50, who proceeded to perform sad imitations of Catskills-era comics. Stale jokes, take-my-wife-please jokes, dirty jokes, or what our grandparents used to call naughty jokes. Our laughter was generous, in the sense that we pretended to be hearing these punchlines for the first time. The only up-to-date material came from references to a relatively new drug called Viagra. Finally, a source of humor fresher than an Oldsmobile Cutlass. Al Lewis had been mostly silent as he watched these Ed Sullivan rejects. At last, he was introduced. Strapping on his accordion, Al instantly came alive. We were the best-dressed audience of six-year-olds he'd ever seen. Look, I can make my accordion sound like a train. And he did. Or birds. And he did. Or an airplane. Kill me now. Next, Al played a medley of instrumentals that represented some of the countries he'd visited. Italy, Germany, Ireland, Israel, saying, "For you, Lenny," he played a song for his Jewish buddy. Sunrise, Sunset. It was actually written for a Broadway musical set in Russia. But hey, Al's heart was in the right place, even if his song wasn't. Same for Lady of Spain, which was composed by British songwriters. Nobody really cared. Unfortunately, Al's enthusiasm made him suddenly lose his balance, and wham, he hit the floor, hard. As everyone went silent, people rushed over. When it became clear that nothing serious had happened, Al rose, steadied himself, smiled his smile, and started the song over. A true pro. You won't be surprised to learn that this brief but unsettling interruption was cut from the official video with digital garden shears. Yes, it was another flawless evening at Masonette. And unfortunately, we are out of time for today's broadcast and actually the entire month of October's issue of Cincinnati Magazine. Please join me, Donna Shapley, next week when we'll begin reading the November issue of Cincinnati Magazine.